Brethren, I see that you availed yourself of the opportunity to see our dear sister Bleachers when you had an opportunity upstairs. I want to mention, I also said to you to give me greetings that you may not have shared with others. There are greetings here from the ecclesias in France and also Belgium, from Beauvillers and Stachelfelden, which is in the Alsace region, and Charleroi in Belgium, brought to us by the young Rozarskis. Rozarski. Young people. At this time, we're going to take a meditative look at the scriptures again. This is Brother Wesley's title, Agreement in or with? In. Agreement in Horeb. Agreement in Horeb. And we encourage you to have your Bibles open. Dig through them with Brother Wesley and rejoice in the prospect that these words can enrich ourselves, enrich our hearts, and stimulate us in zeal. We encourage you now to give him your complete attention. Brother Wesley.
Thank you, Brother Bob, and Brother Rolando. And good morning, brethren. It's our privilege and pleasure to be with you. Sister Tony and I are rejoicing to be in your midst, and we do love the. We're very glad to bring you the loving greetings of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia, who are here with you in spirit. It was about 3 months and 200 miles after the Exodus that the children of Israel came into the desert of Sinai. And I believe most Bible scholars locate that area down toward the southerly tip of the Sinai Peninsula. And here the Lord had special lessons for natural Israel. He kept them there approximately 14 months. Why? Because they had just made the exodus from Egypt. And he needed to take the time to organize them as a nation. He needed to take the time to organize them religiously. They needed to be organized in terms of their civil government. They needed to be organized militarily. There was much instruction given to natural Israel in the desert of Sinai. But there's one other thing that happened in the desert of Sinai. Of all the things that happened to him, there was only one that we're really going to focus on. Brought to our attention in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. And Moses called all Israel and said unto them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your ears this day, that ye may learn them and keep them and do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not his covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us who are all of here, this alive with us this day. Verse 2 identifies our subject. This is the agreement that was made in Horeb between God and natural Israel. And this is going to be our sole focus for the balance of our time. And in this time, we want to explore three different aspects of this agreement. First of all, we want to look at the formation of this agreement. Exactly how was this agreement formed? We're going to actually walk through the steps. Secondly, what are the terms of this covenant? If someone were to ask you to write down right now, what is the old covenant? Write it down. What would you write? What are the terms? What does this covenant mean? And thirdly, what did this covenant accomplish? Formation, terms, accomplishment. We'll try to hit those three items in the balance of our time. Now, before we talk about the formation of this agreement, in the scriptures, as a practical matter, in our everyday life, for at least most of us, I don't know about some of the other countries, but I am a little bit familiar with this country, about how contracts are formed. And they're formed, they're brought into existence by two ways. One is a bilateral agreement, and secondly is a unilateral agreement. Bi, as you know, is two, and the bilateral comes from the fact that the agreement is formed by a mutual exchange of promises. One party makes a promise to the other, the recipient party makes a promise back. There's a reciprocal promise that's offered. That's how the contract is brought into existence. A unilateral contract, on the other hand, there's only one person making any promises. And the contract is brought into formation, it's brought into existence by the accepting party actually performing what the offering party was offering. A couple of examples. Let's assume that Brother John over here needs a pen. I have a pen in my... Well, it's a pencil, but anyway. I have a pencil in my pocket. Brother John needs a pencil. I say to Brother John, look, at the end of this hour, I need this pencil right now, but at the end of this hour, I promise to sell you this pencil for 25 cents. And Brother John looks it over and he says, you know, I could really use a pencil. So he says, I promise I'll give you that 25 cents. I made a promise to Brother John. Brother John made a promise to me. Contract is formed when he makes his return mutual promise. I haven't delivered the pencil yet, and I won't until the end of the hour. But that's a bilateral contract that Brother John and I just made. All right, let's change the example a little bit. Let's assume I take this pencil out of my pocket and I say, Brother John, I'll give you this pencil if you run down to the store and bring me and sit right here on this table a jug of water. So Brother John runs down to the store and he gets a jug of water and he brings back and sits it on the table. Is there a contract? Yes. When did it come into existence? It's when Brother John sat the jug of water on the table. He never said a word. He never made a reciprocal promise because that wasn't what the contract was asking for. The contract was asking for performance. And the contract did not come into existence until Brother John performed. If he would have said along the way, okay, Brother Wes, I promise I'll go down to the store and get you a jug of water. Contract? No. Because the contract was not asking for a reciprocal promise. So you have to distinguish when you're looking at covenants and agreements, what kind is it? Is it bilateral or is it unilateral? We suggest that the Old Law Covenant, which is our focus for today, is a bilateral contract. It was brought into existence by a mutual exchange of promises between Israel through Moses and God. In going through the scriptures, we find that the contract, the Old Law Covenant, was brought into existence in seven steps. Now, this seven was actually interesting for us because we didn't start out to look at the scriptures and say, gee, how can we twist things to kind of make it come out to seven, because seven is a number of completeness. We just took each step as it appeared in the scriptures, and when we were all done, we added them up, and guess how many there were? Seven. Let's go through the seven. We're looking at Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 through 7. Remember the context. Israel, natural Israel at this point, is in the desert of Sinai. God speaking in verse 5. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. The first element in the formation of the Old Law Covenant was God's offer. And that's what verses 5 through 7 are. They constitute God's offer that he was making to Israel. It was his promise. He started the ball rolling by making a promise to them. What did he promise? He said, oh, if you keep my commandments and keep my covenant, you'll be a peculiar treasure, you'll be a holy nation, a kingdom of priests, and so on. It's a tremendous offer. So what was the response to this? Let's read on, verses 8 and 9. And all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Moses, lo, I come unto thee in the thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with thee and believe thee forever. And Moses told the words of the people unto the Lord. Here's the reciprocal promise. God made a promise to him, to the people of Israel, and Israel, the people of Israel, through Moses, make a return promise. And the return promise is, all these things we will do. Now, you say, well, looks like this lesson's all over. We have a promise, we have a reciprocal promise. We're all done, right? Well, we're only to step number two. At this point in time, we're given to understand that what has transpired so far is only two of the seven steps in terms of the full completion of the formation of the Old Law Covenant, not the completed. The agreement isn't fully yet come into existence with these two, even though maybe at first glance it appears as that way. What God was doing here was he was making a contract. The contract, the Old Law Covenant, was only made tentatively at this point. God was merely asking Israel whether they were ready to make a covenant. Were they ready to do his will? They were not yet prepared to enter into the contract. In the commercial world, letters of intent are quite common, and perhaps some of you have had experience with that in larger commercial transactions, where one party will get together with another party. Sometimes the large corporate mergers you talk about, there's an enormous number of details that have to be worked out. But so the parties at times will enter into a preliminary contract, what's called a letter of intent, a binding letter of intent. And in this, the purpose for that is so that the one party makes a basic framework of a commitment to the other party, and the other party makes a commitment to that same arrangement. But it's not the completion. All the details aren't worked out. But that way, each party knows, hey, we're kind of committed to one another. You're not going to go looking for a buyer somewhere else, and you're not going to go look for a seller someplace else. We've made this tentative commitment to one another. And from that point until the full contract is prepared, all the myriad of details are worked out. The preparations for the entry into the full contractual arrangement are done after this binding letter of intent is entered into. We're suggesting we can parallel these two, this account up to this point, as a binding letter of intent between Israel and God. So let's go on to step number three. Let's read verses 10 through 12. And the Lord said unto Moses, go unto the people and sanctify them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes, and be ready against the third day. For the third day the Lord will come down in the sight of all the people upon Mount Sinai. And thou shalt set bounds upon the people round about, saying, take heed to yourselves that ye go not up into the mount, or touch the border of it. Whosoever toucheth the mount shall be surely put to death. The binding letter of intent is made. Now it's time to prepare the people to enter into the covenant with God, the full covenant in the fullest sense of the word. So what was Moses instructed to do? He was instructed to have the people consecrate themselves, to sanctify themselves. He was to instruct the people to wash their clothes, to clean up, to get ready. They were about to enter into a very important arrangement with the Lord in the fullest sense of the word, and they were to get ready. They were not to have any intimacy. They were to go through and have this various elements of instruction committed to their hearts and to their minds to prepare them. And that's step number three, preparation. The preparation of the people to enter into the full arrangement with God. So what happens then? We come to the third day, the day that the covenant was to be made. We're still suggesting that this part would be rightly categorized under the preparation of the people element. Verse 17. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the nether part of the mount. And at this point, we'll go over to chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. 24, 1 and 2. And he said unto Moses, come up to the Lord, thou, and Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go up with him. Still as a part of this preparation, capture the scene. The people were told to gather around the foot of the mountain. Then we have Aaron, we have Nadab, we have Abihu, and we have 70 of the elders. We're to go further up the mountain, but not all the way. There was only one man that went all the way to the top of that peak. Who was that? Moses. Moses alone communicated with God. So here we have all these steps being under the arrangement or under the element of the people being prepared. And then finally, in step number 4 of the arrangement of the formation of the contract, we can go back to chapter 20 in Exodus, and particularly verses 1 to 17. And we suggest, and we're given to understand, and you might recognize verses 1 to 17 as being the Ten Commandments. And these were told to Moses. This is what God, this was his offer. The old law covenant constitutes, Ten Commandments constitute God's offer to Israel. And we take a look at Exodus chapter 24, verse 3, but just the first half. Exodus 24, 3. It says, "And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord." What were the words of the Lord? Verse 20, chapter 20, verse 1 says, "All these are the words of the Lord." The Ten Commandments. That's what God told Moses when he went up and met God alone at the peak of the mountain. "And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments." So here it is. Here's the offer communicated, God's offer to the people, communicated to Moses. The terms of the contract are the Ten Commandments. Last part of verse 3 brings us to step number 5 in the formation of this contract. It says, "And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do." There it is. There's the reciprocal promise. So now the contract is fully into existence, right? Well, not quite. We're not to step 7 yet. We have the reciprocal promises, but the Lord arranged that there would be more to the formation of this contract than just these steps thus far. Let's consider Exodus 24, verses 4 through 8, which will be step number 6. Exodus 24, 4 to 8. "And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord and rose up early in the morning and built an altar under the hill and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings and oxen unto the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and put it in the basins and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said will we do and be obedient." And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words." Step number 6 is the sealing of the covenant with blood. And that's what we have here. Notice after the slaughter of the animals, the blood is sprinkled two places. It's sprinkled upon the altar, first of all. It's sprinkled upon the book. And secondly, in verse 8, we can see that it was sprinkled upon the people. We won't take the time to look at it. But if you want to consider Hebrews chapter 9, verse 19, in this connection, because Paul picks up on this point when he's discussing the new covenant, which is one of the reasons, by the way, we want to understand pretty thoroughly the old law covenant. So Moses first sprinkles the law, the books, justice being satisfied. And then he sprinkles the people, indicating that they are justified, typically speaking. So now the old law covenant is in force. But yet there's one more. The seventh administrative step in the creation of this contract is brought to our attention as we go on in chapter 24. Chapter 24, verse 12. "And the Lord said unto Moses, come up into the mount and be there, and I will give thee tables of stone and a law and commandments which I have written that thou mayest teach them." You know, whenever you finish up a real estate transaction, and many of us here have been engaged in either buying or selling or both a piece of real estate, what last step? I'll ask Sister Dawn over here. She knows what the last step is. You go to the courthouse and you record the deed. And that's what was happening here. The words of this covenant, the terms of this contract were written in stone. They were recorded. And that's step number 7. The recording of the terms of the contract in stone. Now we know that Moses no more than came back down from the mountain and he found the people doing what? Violating the very thing that they just said that they would do. Disobedience. So what did he do? We all know the story. He broke the tablets. And then he was told to come back up, and this time he would write he would inscribe the stone tablets. But all that together would be what we would characterize as the recording of this contract, recording of the terms of the contract. So there we have it. We have the offer of the preliminary contract, the acceptance of the preliminary contract, the preparation of the people, the offer of the full terms of the contract by God to Israel, the acceptance by the people, their reciprocal promise, the sealing of the covenant with blood, and finally the recording of the terms of that contract in stone. So now we fully, the old law covenant has now been brought fully into existence with these steps. Let's go to our second question. What does the old law covenant mean? What does it say? Well, we have some pretty good idea when we looked over there in Exodus chapter 19 and we saw the terms of the preliminary arrangement, and we look at chapter 20 and we see the delineation of the Ten Commandments. But in plain language, what is the essence? What is the meaning of the old law covenant? Well, several years later, when Israel was about to go into the Promised Land, just shortly prior to that, Moses speaks to them. And we think that Moses gives a beautiful summary of the essence, the meaning, the true meaning of the Old Law Covenant in Deuteronomy, the 30th chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 through 19. See, I have set before thee this day life and good and death and evil. And that I command thee this day to love the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that thou mayest live and multiply. And the Lord thy God shall bless thee in the land whither thou goest to possess it. And if thine heart turn away, so that thou wilt not hear, but shall be drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I denounce unto you this day that ye shall surely perish, and that ye shall not prolong your days upon the land whither thou passest over Jordan to go to possess it. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, and both thou and thy seed may live. So here we have it. In plain, simple terms, Moses delineates the terms and conditions of the old law covenant. Obey and live. Disobey and die. That's it. But now there's one thing that we want to consider further before we leave the idea of what are the terms of the contract. And that is, how does the old law covenant relate specifically to the Ten Commandments? You know, for years, friends, I don't know how you were given to understand it, the way we were given to understand the Ten Commandments is that God went down and knocked on Israel's door one day, slammed open the door, and he said, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and so on down through the Ten Commandments. And that these were just unilateral edicts that he imposed upon the people of Israel. But notice, friends, where the old law covenant and how it relates, how it comes into the picture and how it relates as we go through this particular account. The old law covenant is the agreement that's based upon the Ten Commandments. By way of contrast, United States Congress is always imposing things on you and me, like paying taxes, and one of the most sweeping pieces of legislation recently enacted, and perhaps some of you, in fact, eventually all of you will be affected by it in a more or less direct fashion. That's the Americans with Disabilities Act, one of the most sweeping pieces of legislation that's going to change how we treat and deal with one another. Did anybody come and ask you if you wanted that piece of legislation? No. And see, I think that's by way of contrast. That's how I used to think of the old law covenant, is God just handing down this piece of legislation and said, you'll do this. But now we see that as we go through that the old law, the Ten Commandments are the terms of the contract. It's not a unilateral edict that God handed down. They already told God, look, tell us whatever you want us to do, whatever your covenant is, whatever you want ask of us, we will do it. And God says, here are the terms of the contract. Not an edict. They asked for these things. They agreed to them. They agreed to commit to them. The old law covenant is the reward for perfect compliance. It contains the reward for perfect compliance with the Ten Commandments. And the old law covenant contains the penalty for disobedience to the Ten Commandments. So here we see then the Ten Commandments being the essence, the terms and conditions of the old law contract, of the old law covenant. Let's consider our third point, and that is the accomplishments of the old law covenant. You'd say, well, I have a pretty good idea what those are, because Paul talks about them. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 19. He says, for the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by the which we draw nigh unto God. The law. Now, when we read the law here, friends, we should think old law covenant, not just the Ten Commandments, but the agreement that was based upon the Ten Commandments. It says the law made nothing perfect. The old law covenant made nothing perfect. Nobody got life under it. Paul also talks about it in Romans chapter 3, verse 20. Romans 3:20 says, therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in thy sight. So nobody got justification under it. And even worse, the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 7, verse 10, Romans 7:10, Paul says, and the commandment, which we would understand here to be the old law covenant, and the old law covenant which was ordained to life, which was supposed to give life, I found to be under death. I found to be unto death. That's a pretty bleak picture of the old law covenant, isn't it? It didn't justify anybody. Nobody got life under it. And what's worse, they were condemned by it. So the common conclusion, and perhaps our most common thinking on the old law covenant, is that, boy, this thing was basically a bad news covenant. It just didn't do anybody any good. In fact, it did them harm. But friends, that's not true. And we are going to suggest that there are three positive accomplishments that came out of the old law covenant. Let's take a look at the first one. Paul gives it to us in Galatians 3:19. Galatians chapter 3, verse 19. Paul says, wherefore then serveth the law? Now again, think here, when you see law, think old law covenant. Think the agreement that Israel and God entered into. And Paul says, it was added. What's it? The old law covenant. What was it added to? The Abrahamic. The old law covenant was added to the Abrahamic covenant because of transgression. Now what does that mean? It was given to them because of transgression. Paul beautifully, I believe, explains what this means in the very last portion of Romans 3:20. Romans 3:20. In the very last part of it, Paul says, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. The old law covenant really gave Israel a standard. It gave them a standard to live by. You know, and there's an adage that is frequently talked about, and that is, where there is no law, there is no sin. Isn't that true? If there's no law, then there's no law to break. Conversely, if there is a law, that dictates a standard, a particular standard of conduct. And when we have a law, we can deduce from that what is sin, because any violation of that law is going to be sin. It's going to be an infraction of that. And so here, Israel was given the old law covenant because it was a goal, it was a standard. It helped to restrain them from sin. It kept Israel from sinking lower and lower and lower, unlike the Gentile nations. The Gentile nations were sinking down, down, down. Israel was given the Old Law Covenant as a standard to live by. So it actually helped to lift them up. And that's beautifully illustrated. And I know some of you are studying the pyramid right now. But beautifully studied, illustrated in the by the first ascending passage in the Great Pyramid. And not only was the Old Law Covenant, not only did it have an ennobling, an uplifting influence upon the conduct of the people of Israel, but you know, I think we find in the laws that you and I are subject to in this day and age that there are many principles. I would submit that the criminal code in most states is based very, very basically upon the provisions of the Ten Commandments. And I think we find as we look through our system of jurisprudence that you and I are subject to, that we find a lot of things in the Old Law that actually have found their way, yes, not perfectly, we're not suggesting that, but in principle, in concept, we can find a number of the things that you and I live with today in the Ten Commandments. So that was the first thing. It had this ennobling or uplifting influence upon the people of Israel and upon their conduct. It gave them a standard. It told them how to act and told them how not to act. But beyond that, a second reason or a second accomplishment would be in Galatians, the third chapter, verse 24. Galatians 3:24. Where Paul says, wherefore the law, and again, think Old Law Covenant here, wherefore the Old Law Covenant was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ, that we might be justified by faith. And so that's the second accomplishment of the Old Law Covenant. It was a schoolmaster. And Paul says here, it brought us to Christ. And of course, it didn't bring a lot, it didn't bring them all, but it certainly brought some. And how did it do that? Well, the Old Law Covenant certainly taught many of the natural Israelites that they could not live up to the Old Law Covenant. They could not get life under it because they could not obey it perfectly. And of course, after many, many years of trying, they realized that they could not get life by their own efforts. They realized that they needed help. They realized they needed a justifier. They needed to be justified. And of course, that would come through our Lord. Romans chapter 10. Verse 4. Romans 10:4. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to every one that believeth. 10:4 tells us that Jesus fulfilled the Old Law Covenant. And to those natural Israelites who were under the Old Law Covenant, who had entered into that arrangement, and their descendants were also under that arrangement, and still are, to those who wanted to be free from that condemnation that was brought upon them, only required that they believe, because Christ fulfilled it to everyone that believeth. To those who believe in Jesus, the Old Law Covenant is fulfilled to them. They no longer have to worry about it. They're no longer condemned by it. And we know that some did respond to this offer, this arrangement, the apostles and the disciples, the faithful remnant, and so on. But this was how that the Lord made yet a second accomplishment from the Old Law Covenant and that arrangement. We're going to suggest a third accomplishment by the Old Law Covenant. Let's consider Galatians chapter 3, verse 12. Galatians 3:12. It says, and the law is not of faith, but the man that doeth them shall live in them. We're going to suggest to you a couple of one excellent reprint. Reprint 5164 and 5165. Jesus fulfilled the Old Law Covenant, as we just mentioned a moment ago. Jesus earned the prize of life. Remember, that was the reward that was held out to those who would obey fully, completely, the terms and conditions of the Old Law Covenant, life. Jesus earned the prize of life that contractual arrangement offered. And he voluntarily sacrificed that right to perfect, eternal human life. And that sacrifice we call the ransom. And Brother Russell's got some excellent thoughts along this line in reprint 51, 64, and 65. And we'll also give you a reprint 4905 in addition to that. We suggest that Jesus' ransom merit, the anti-lutron that you and I hold so precious as our fundamental doctrine of our faith, that ransom merit arises directly out of his obedience to this contractual arrangement. The ransom merit arises not only out of his obedience to that arrangement, but his willingness and his voluntarily sacrificing the life rights that he earned under that contractual arrangement. That's how he earned them. Without the old law covenant, there is no justification. There would be no justification possible for you and I. Without the old law covenant, there would be no basis for eternal life for the world. No restitution. We suggest that without the old law covenant, there could be no ransom. That's how closely connected his obedience is, his earning that right to eternal, perfect human life that he sacrificed is related to the old law covenant. Friends, the old law covenant was not bad news. The old law covenant was good news.
Are we not encouraged by such words to look more deeply into our Lord's words? We are thankful that the Lord has put into our brother Wesley's hands, so to speak, the talent of his avocation, which he can then take and use and synthesize and examine and bring to our attention in a very orderly fashion such matters as covenants and so forth, that we can get a grasp on these as well. Very encouraging and also very clearly presented. We're thankful for that. We call to your attention our reminder from before. Please go as soon as possible to the cafeteria. Please avail yourself of the rides so we can get started there. And when you return, we'll be having not the music playing, but there'll be another example of some of the audio reprints playing. We want to remind you that the tape purchases are made upstairs in the back. Please do that. And then our brother Dick Lolly has told us that the book table will be closed and dismantled at 1:45 p.m. Please make your purchases prior to the beginning of the afternoon session. We're going to close at this time with the use of Brother Wesley's choice of a hymn, number 168. And we're going to follow a practice that we used many years ago and probably still practiced in Patterson, but when I was attending there with Sister Rebecca, and Sister Ruth, of course, was attending there at the same time, if I'm not mistaken. At the end of the prayer, if you'll just remain quietly, she will conclude the portion with a portion of the hymn, which is standardly done at the Patterson meetings. And it ends the prayer in a nice, quiet, and solemn way, which we encourage you to use for your final meditations during the prayer time. Let us sing together that hymn now. Hymn number 168. seated. Before closing prayer, we've been asked just a few moments ago if we could just ask you to bear with us. We need to get a count for the cafeteria. Could you just raise your hands if you will not be eating at the cafeteria at this time? Brother Kenneth would like to take a quick count.
Keep your hands up, please.
Or Brother Ken. Brethren, we'd like to turn our attention now to a quiet time of prayer. As we conclude, we'd like to ask our brother Wes to come to the lectern, and would you please rise?
Eternal God and loving Father, with stammering heart and feeble tongue, we approach thy heavenly throne of grace this morning. We thank thee so much, Father, for the time that thou hast taken to reveal thyself unto us through thy word. We appreciate the Bible, appreciate all the study aids that thou hast given us to enable us to comprehend another small portion of the heights and the depths and the breadths of thy love for all thy creation. We thank thee, Father, for the blessings of the past lesson. Help us to take them to heart, that they may bear forth their designed fruitage, that all might be renowned to thy name's glory and honor. Continue to help us to appreciate the ransom, the precious ransom for all, more fully and more deeply than ever. And Father, for anything thought or said or done which was displeasing or out of harmony, we ask it to be overruled for our highest spiritual welfare, and most of all, to thy name's glory. Through Christ we pray. Amen.